have to stop violence, give up their weapons, and come out peacefully and take the instructions from the police.
That is what Carrie Lam wants protesters to do. We will take you to Hong Kong. This is Wednesday, the 20th of November. This is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, talks break down between the United States and South Korea over the cost of U.S. troops there. And impeachment hearings against Donald Trump continue in Washington. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Waves of student protesters in Hong Kong attempted daring escapes past police lines while less than 200 others remain barricaded inside a university that's been surrounded by riot police since Sunday. VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Hong Kong the protesters are getting increasingly desperate.
Some students have attempted dramatic escapes, sliding down ropes to waiting motorcycles, which tried to zoom past police lines and clouds of tear gas to free them. Others have chosen to stay at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University. VOA Cantonese service reporter Iris Tong was inside the campus and described scenes of exhaustion and desperation.
I can feel their hopeless. Yeah, so it is quite sad to see the situation like that, yeah. But I saw two boys, yeah. They're all teenagers, two people. I saw one boy, he just said he wanted to kill himself, but I didn't see him really cut and hurt, and I didn't see any blood from his neck.
Police have ordered the protesters to drop their homemade weapons and leave campus through a single exit, where they likely would face riot-related charges. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam defended police actions and sharply criticized the protesters.
They have to stop violence, give up their weapons, and come out peacefully and take the instructions from the police.
Police have fired tear gas and rubber bullets at those attempting to flee. At night, waves of protesters have tried unsuccessfully to breach police lines and reach the campus with supplies. The clashes are some of the worst violence since anti-government protests began in Hong Kong 5 months ago. Neither Beijing nor Hong Kong authorities show signs of giving in. Some pro-democracy activists were encouraged earlier this week when Hong Kong's High Court ruled that the government's recent ban on face masks was unconstitutional. The face mask ban, which went into effect last month, punished offenders with up to a year in jail. But China's top legislature on Tuesday slammed the court ruling, insisting Hong Kong courts have no authority to rule on the legality of legislation. Beijing's statement fundamentally threatens the rule of law in Hong Kong, says lawyer and author Anthony Dabberin.
But if they do go ahead with this and formally interpret the basic law that prevents the Hong Kong courts from reviewing the constitutionality of legislation, that is a fundamental change to the Hong Kong legal system. It pulls away one of the struts that props up the Hong Kong rule of law.
Many Hong Kongers are outraged by the steady erosion of the one country, two systems policy that Beijing has used to govern Hong Kong since Britain handed it over to China in 1997. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Hong Kong.
We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. Pakistan's former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, who's serving a 7-year jail term for corruption and money laundering, left for London Tuesday to receive medical treatment there. After a month of preparations and goodbyes, Bebe, the Washington National Zoo's most eligible giant panda bachelor, is on his way to China, where scientists hope he'll help increase the population of his species. India's state-run banks reported fraud worth 598 billion rupees, that's $13.3 billion, from April to the end of September of this year. The country's finance minister said that Tuesday as the government struggles to help banks recoup losses. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia. in South Korea broke down Tuesday over Washington's demand to increase Seoul's financial contribution to hosting U.S. military forces on its soil. South Korean negotiator Jung Eun-bo told reporters the U.S. side walked out after a short session. James DeHart is the U.S. negotiator.
Unfortunately, the proposals that were put forward by the Korean negotiating team were not responsive to our request for fair and equitable burden sharing.
Seoul currently pays just over $890 million to defray the cost of the 28,500 U.S. troops stationed on South Korea to defend the country against a possible attack from the north. South Korean officials say the Trump administration wants to raise the amount to as much as $5 billion.
We cut short our participation in the talks today in order to give the Korean side some time to reconsider, and I hope to put forward new proposals.
U.S. President Donald Trump has long complained that U.S. allies haven't paid Washington enough for the bases and troops used in their defense. During a visit to Seoul last week, U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper said South Korea is a wealthy country that could and should pay more to help offset the cost of defense. U.S. negotiator DeHart expressed his hope that the talks would resume.
We look forward to resuming our negotiations when the Korean side is ready to work on the basis of partnership and on the basis of mutual trust.
The communist-led North and democratically elected South, assisted by U.S. forces, fought a three-year war that ended in a truce in 1953, leaving the two sides in a technical state of war still. Western hostages Tuesday after the Afghan government released three key Taliban prisoners who were flown to Qatar, where the Taliban has a political team. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us. The U.S. House Intelligence Committee impeachment inquiry was hearing testimony Tuesday from several top national security aides who listened in on a July 25th telephone call between U.S. President Donald Trump and Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky. In the morning session, Jennifer Williams, an aide to Vice President Mike Pence, and the National Security Council's Ukraine expert, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, appeared before the committee. Both were witnesses too and expressed concerns about the phone call that is at the center of the investigation into Trump's alleged efforts to pressure Ukrainian officials to investigate his political rivals. In his opening statement, the House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff reiterated the central issue of the investigation regarding the call between Trump and Zelensky.
To press a foreign leader to announce an investigation into his political rival, President Trump put his own personal and political interests above those of the nation. He undermined our military and diplomatic support for a key ally and undercut U.S. anti-corruption efforts in Ukraine.
In his remarks, the ranking Republican on the Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, continued to maintain that the inquiry is politically motivated and said he wants to hear from the whistleblower whose complaint launched the probe.
What was the full extent of the whistleblower's prior coordination with Chairman Schiff, his staff, and any other people he cooperated with while preparing the complaint? What are the whistleblower's political biases and connections to Democratic politicians? How does the whistleblower explain the inaccuracies in the complaint? What contact did the whistleblower have with the media, which appears to be ongoing? What are the sources of the whistleblower's information? Who else did he talk to? And was the whistleblower prohibited by law from receiving or conveying any of that information?
In her opening statement, Williams repeated testimony she had previously given during a closed-door deposition.
As I testified then, I found the July 25th phone call unusual because, in contrast to other presidential calls I had observed, it involved discussion of what appeared to be a domestic political matter. After the July 25th call, I provided an update in the Vice President's daily briefing book indicating that President Trump had a call that day with President Zelensky.
In his opening comments, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman's comments regarding the call went a bit further than that.
I was concerned by the call. What I heard was inappropriate, and I reported my concerns to Mr. Eisenberg. It is improper for the President of the United States to demand a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen and a political opponent. It was also clear that if Ukraine pursued an investigation into the 2016 elections, the Bidens and Burisma, it would be interpreted as a partisan play.
The afternoon committee sessions feature testimony from former U.S. Special Envoy to Ukraine, Kurt Volker, and the former National Security Council Director for European and Russian Affairs, Tim Morrison. Covering the hearings and joining us live is BOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, what's happening now?
Well, we're still hearing that testimony from Volker and Morrison. We're really in the middle here of a marathon hearing, reaching about hour 8 of testimony. But I've really seen what's emerging today is a sequence. We're seeing the witnesses getting closer and closer to President Trump and to that July 25th phone call. We're getting firsthand witnesses to that phone call today. And then, of course, tomorrow we have what may be the biggest day of all of the hearings when we hear from the former U.S. ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, who is one of those so-called three amigos who were running an allegedly irregular channel of U.S. foreign policy in Ukraine. That'll be a key hearing for the House Democrats tomorrow.
Now, what about the Republicans? Are they continuing the same line of questioning and accusations that they started with?
Well, we heard one of the Republican lines of questioning in that Nunez soundbite that you just played. But they're also saying that in terms of the Democrats' argument, there's smoke but no fire. That, sure, the U.S. congressionally approved U.S. aid to Ukraine was held up for a few weeks, but it eventually reached Ukraine. President Trump may have asked for help investigating his domestic political rival, but ultimately that didn't happen. The Ukrainian president didn't come out and make any statements on TV, as some have alleged. So really, when you're looking at it, Republicans will say, well, what did the president get? He didn't get anything. That can't possibly rise to the level of an impeachable offense.
BOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, you might be right where you are tomorrow at this time, and we'll talk to you then, okay? Without leaving, as a matter of fact. Who knows?
We'll see about that.
Thanks, Catherine. Coming up, a ballet in the Philippines is having its problems. We'll tell you why and what they're doing about it. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. With VOA Asia, also follow radio program hosts VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
This news alert from VOA Asia. The economic losses in Kashmir have run well over $1 billion since India revoked its autonomy and statehood in August. The main trade body in the Himalayan region said that, adding that it planned to sue the government for damages. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues now. Time for the VOA Business Scene Report. From fierce typhoons and tight budgets to losing its dancers to cruise ships and theme parks, Ballet Philippines has weathered almost every type of storm. But as it celebrates its 50th anniversary, the renowned arts organization is determined to show it will go on. Funding is difficult to secure, and there is little money for necessities such as dancers' salaries or even shoes. But more than 30,000 people watched the troupe's productions last year, a solid accomplishment in a nation where millions live on less than $2 a day. One of the biggest challenges is keeping the dancers that is trained. Principal dancer Denise Parungao, who started out as a $40 a month apprentice at the troupe, says she relied on family to help pay her rent and understands why others left.
In Ballet Philippines, a dancer wears that for the whole month. They put glue, they varnish, they do everything just to make it last.
Ballet Philippines remains on a short list of developing nations that have their own ballet troupes, including Vietnam, China, Cuba, and Brazil. Cultural Center of the Philippines Artistic Director says the troupe's reputation confirms it is one of the best in Asia. Bottle cap noses and long pink hair made from shredded plastic bags create special puppets manipulated by Indonesian school children who are taking their show on the road to the capital, Jakarta, from their home on the central island of Lombok. In a year when young people worldwide have followed the example of Swedish teenage climate activist Greta Thunberg in flagging environmental concerns, these Indonesian students are using plastic items to make the puppet characters that teach the importance of protecting the environment. The founder, Abdul Latif, wants people to understand how serious the problem is.
Small amounts of waste that we are hoarding in our homes can become a big ghost. It can fill the guts of dead whales and get stuck in the noses of dead turtles at sea. If we underestimate the amount of trash, it can cause bigger problems.
Latif's troupe started to make puppets from plastic waste last year. It is a disposal method that generates educational material for audiences dominated by children in a country home to a strong tradition of shadow puppetry known as wayang kulit. Most of the puppeteers are aged from about 7 to 16. They collect and sort through waste from their own neighborhoods, washing plastic containers and painting faces on paper cups before assembling the figurines using bamboo sticks. They seem to be fully on board with the environmental message. For VOA Business Scene, I'm Ira Melman. This news break from VOA Asia, the Philippines will outlaw the use and importation of e-cigarettes and arrest anyone using them. That according to its president on Tuesday, joining a growing number of nations moving to ban devices that have been linked to deaths and addiction. President Rodrigo Duterte announced the order during a late-night news conference. This is VOA Asia. A few Pakistani women friends working for big tech companies in the United States decided that they wanted to create the mentoring and professional network they wish they had had when they were coming up in the business world. The result is the Seattle-based Pakistani Women in Computing, or PWIC. VOA's Nadim Yaqub recently visited the Seattle chapter of PWIC and filed this report.
PWIC is an online network of Pakistani women working in the tech industry. Its mission is simple: to inspire, encourage, and help other women in IT around the world.
We are very inclusive. Everyone who needs help can approach us. It's just that we're from Pakistan, so we have a special connection with that country. But our ideology is to create awareness and really help others.
The network organizes trainings and awareness programs for women. A recent workshop focused on teaching other women and students how to prepare for the professional world.
To learn how you write resumes, and I think this will be really helpful when I get older and when I'm applying for jobs, because it's a really essential part when you're trying to get a job in the United States today.
But members of this network group aren't always seeking employment. Some are professionals in the field looking to better their careers.
So in corporate America, one of the skills that is very, very highly valued is actually leadership qualities. Or PWIC, there are a lot of women who've actually reached those high ranks, and I look up to them.
When I was growing up, there was no such organization where I could see other women in the technology industry and aspire to be like them.
PWIC has established 5 chapters, including one in Pakistan.
We are trying to give global visibility to tech women in Pakistan, and for that we are undertaking a few programs like mentoring, storytelling, and publishing their interviews. We give the exposure about the conferences and job opportunities in the U.S. market.
PWIC founders say the network has funded IT training workshops in Pakistan and plans to start a scholarship program for girls studying computer sciences so that they can take advantage of this rapidly growing industry. Nadim Yaqub, VOA News, Seattle, Washington.
U.S. President Donald Trump Tuesday warned that failure to get a trade deal with China will prompt more tariffs. At the White House, he told reporters, if we don't make a deal with China, I'll just raise the tariffs even higher. Trump's latest tough comment came as markets are watching intensely for signs of progress in the two economic superpowers. Their attempt to reach a so-called Phase One partial deal, taking the heat out of a growing trade war. Predictions of a resolution have come and gone repeatedly as Trump veers from hints of imminent deals to declaring his satisfaction with the current standoff because the United States is pulling in billions of dollars in trade tariffs, he says. Skeptics say even a partial pact hinges on Trump rolling back existing tariffs, something his latest comment about increasing the duties would appear to put that in doubt. A fishing boat caught fire in South Korea's southern waters early Tuesday, and the Coast Guard said a search was underway for 11 people missing. One fisherman had been found unconscious and not breathing in waters 7.4 kilometers south of the boat, with rescue workers airlifting him to a hospital on the nearby island of Jeju. The Coast Guard and Navy were deploying boats, helicopters, and a patrol plane to search the waters near Jeju Island for survivors, according to an official from the Coast Guard in Jeju. Rescue efforts, which also involved civilian fishing vessels, were being slowed by strong winds and large waves in the area. The spokesman said the Coast Guard received a report about the fire around 7 a.m. A Coast Guard helicopter found it about an hour later, and the upper side of the boat had been burned completely. A photo released by the Coast Guard showed the 29-ton boat engulfed in black smoke. Six of the boat's crew were South Koreans. The other six were Vietnamese. They departed from the mainland port of Tongyang on November 8th to catch hairtail and had planned to return to the port on Monday. Time now for Science in a Minute.
This is Science in a Minute.
Diets high in protein but low in carbohydrates are quite popular among people who want to lose weight and hold on to lean muscle mass. Cutting down on the amount of foods high in carbohydrates and replacing them with those rich in proteins and healthy fats is supposed to help the body switch its fuel source from sugars to stored fat. A new paper from researchers at the European Renal Association and the European Dialysis and Transplant Association suggests these diets may also harm your kidneys. The researchers point out that high-protein, low-carbohydrate diets are often recommended to people who suffer from diabetes or who are obese. Denis Fouquet, past chair of the European Renal Nutrition Working Group, says that while a high-protein diet may help these people lose weight, it also comes with a risk of severe loss of kidney function. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Now a bit of a sports story for you. Construction work has been completed at Tokyo's National Stadium, set to be the centerpiece of next year's Olympic Games, according to the site's owners. The Japan Sports Council said the final work had been completed last Thursday, with just the final quality and safety checks remaining before the stadium opens next month. It will be officially unveiled on December 21st, with the Emperor's Cup soccer final being the first sporting event to be held there on New Year's Day. Completed at a cost of more than $1.25 billion, the stadium, which can accommodate 60,000, will also host the athletics and soccer events during the games. The construction started in December of 2016, about 14 months later than planned, after the original design was scrapped because of a public outcry over spiraling cost. That delay meant the stadium could not host matches of the Rugby World Cup as originally planned. The National Stadium is one of eight new venues to be used at the Tokyo Games, all of them either complete or on schedule to be finished before the event. The Olympics, by the way, run from July 24th to August 9th. You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. Visit our VOAnews.com program page. See us on YouTube. Follow us on VOA Asia Twitter. And let's hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook and our email, VOAasia@VOAnews.com. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Dan Crafton. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.